So I started the Satipatthana Sutta, I think it was back in November or something, and over 2 weekends I did the first 2 parts of the Satipatthana Sutta, or rather 2 sessions, and we did the body contemplation, the kaya nupassana, and the contemplation of feelings, and then we had the 2 remaining contemplations, the citta nupassana, the contemplation of mind, and the dhamma nupassana left. So if you have a copy of the middle length discourses, we are on page 150 in that book. So just to summarize a couple of the points I made on the 2 previous occasions. The first point I made is that if you want to understand what Satipatthana is all about, you have to see it in context. And when you just read the Satipatthana Sutta in isolation, you don't actually get the context of Satipatthana. To see Satipatthana in context, you have to see it, how it actually operates compared to other factors of the path in the various places in the suttas. And a classic example is in the Noble Eightfold Path. You have Satipatthana being the 7th factor, and then you have Sammasamadhi, or the jhanas, being the 8th factor. And of course you have Sammavayama, which is right effort, being the 6th factor. So Satipatthana is squeezed between right effort and right samadhi, Sammasamadhi. And because the Noble Eightfold Path is like a conditioned sequence of factors, what that means is that the cause that gives rise to Satipatthana is right effort, and the result of Satipatthana is Sammasamadhi or jhana. That's the purpose. That's the aim of Satipatthana, is to attain samadhi, basically. That's what it means. And you see this over and over and over again in the suttas, that this is the pattern and how Satipatthana fits into the context of the other factors of the path. And right effort, the reason why right effort is the cause for Satipatthana, is because right effort is nothing itself but the purification of virtue. If you think of the Noble Eightfold Path, you often start off, the early parts of the path, factor 3, 4, and 5, are about virtue, are about right speech and right action, right livelihood. And then right effort is the purification of the mind, that comes to using the mind in the right way. So that virtue, both through conduct and also mental virtue, is what gives rise to the possibility of Satipatthana practice. And then Satipatthana is that final purification of the mind and the bringing it to unity, in other words, through meditation practice, that then gives rise to Samadhi or Sammasamadhi afterwards. So once you, it's an important point to understand, because if you just study the Satipatthana Sutta without the context, you don't really understand how it fits in to the overall path. So what does that mean? Does that mean that Satipatthana is all about samatha, about calming the mind, and not about vipassana? If it results in samadhi, you might think it's all about samatha practice. But the point is that any practice that leads to purity of the mind, leads to a reduction in the defilement, and that can be both vipassana and samatha. All that, or everything which leads towards jhana, that is, or sammasamadhi, that is part of Satipatthana. So Satipatthana is both samatha and vipassana. It's not one or the other, it's both together. And you can see, when you look at the types of exercises we're talking about here, you can see why that is. You know, it talks about, previously we talked about contemplation of the body, for example, looking at the body in terms of 31 parts. But what you're trying to do here is to see the body more clearly. You're trying to take away some of the desire for the body, to see it more in a more neutral way, so to speak. And of course, seeing things in a more neutral way, in a more clear way, that's part of vipassana. I like to translate vipassana as clear seeing. And that clear seeing comes about by taking away some of the desire which may not actually be warranted when you look at the body in a more neutral sense. And the same thing with the feelings we're talking about as well, which talks about different types of feelings and understanding a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling. Of course, part of that is about vipassana, because you understand the scope of these feelings, you understand how far they go, where they end, and what kind of feelings are preferable on the path compared to other ones, so you can see the progression of your practice, so to speak. One thing I think I didn't mention about the feelings, which is an important aspect we're talking about last time, is that there are the so-called unworldly feelings, they're called in this translation. Niramisa sukha is the Pali word for this, or unworldly happiness. And that unworldly happiness is in the suttas usually defined as the samma samadhi, or jhanas, or samadhi, if you like. Yeah, that's the unworldly happiness. And that is interesting, because very often we talk about satipatthana as one thing here, and then the jhanas and samadhi are something else. But here you see the two merge together. You're actually supposed to contemplate the feeling that comes up in jhanas. You're supposed to contemplate that in satipatthana. In other words, you're bringing the jhanas into the satipatthana practice. Whether the jhanas are a part of the satipatthana, or whether you're just using that experience to practice satipatthana, is really quite irrelevant, I feel. The point is that you're bringing them in as part of this practice. So again, this distinction between vipassana and samatha that you very often hear about is not really found in the suttas. The suttas, the two always go together. Where there's samatha, there will be vipassana. If you're calm and peaceful, you will see clearly. When you see clearly, you will become calm and peaceful. The two always go together. They're part and parcel of the same thing, basically. Okay, so let us move on to the contemplation of the mind. This is the citta nipassana. So on page 150. So I'll read out and then I'll comment on this passage afterwards. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind as mind, it says here. Here a bhikkhu understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, and mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate, and a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. A mind affected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. He understands a contracted mind as contracted, a distracted mind as distracted. He understands an exalted mind as exalted, and an unexalted mind as unexalted. He understands a surpassed mind as a surpassed mind, an unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed. He understands a concentrated mind as concentrated, an unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated. He understands a liberated mind as liberated, an unliberated mind as unliberated. So, first of all, on the very first sentence here, how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating the mind as mind? This word mind is citta in Pali, and it means mind in a very general sense. But citta also often just refers to a particular state of mind. For example, citta is sometimes used as a synonym of samadhi itself in the suttas. So it refers to that state of samadhi, which is a state, particular state of mind. So I think my preferred translation of this is, how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating a mind state among a mind state in the mind? In other words, a particular state in the mind. And that's why you have the whole list here of different types of mind states, and you're contemplating one of those among all possible states, basically. So that is my preferred translation there. And it starts off with the word lust. The word lust here is, let me just check this so I don't give you the wrong information. I think it's raga in this particular case. It's raga. And raga means not just lust in a narrow sense, but in a very broad sense. All kind of desires in particular connected with the five senses is what is meant here. And then you have hate. This is dosa. So again, anger basically, any kind of anger or negativity. And then you have delusion, and delusion is any kind of mind state which lacks clarity. You lack clarity. You see the world in a way that the world actually is not, and you're lacking clarity of mind. So it can be confusion, it can be doubt, etc. All of these things come under delusion. And then you have the contracted mind, and the contracted mind here is a mind which is like locked inside of itself. It's like sloth and torpor. When the mind goes inside, you don't really have a mind which it feels contracted. It feels like you're not really reaching out into the world, so to speak. Yeah? And the distracted mind is the restless mind, the mind which is going out to various places, not really staying at home. So the contracted and distracted are like here opposite sides of the same coin. And what you find here, that these five factors listed here, they are essentially equivalent to the five hindrances. So what you are contemplating here really are the five hindrances. So you understand when the five hindrances are present in the mind and when they are not. This is the first part here. And when it says that you understand, let's take the first hindrance here, which is raga or lust. When it says that you understand a mind as affected by raga, by lust or by desire, it means that you understand it in its full scope, right? In its full breadth. This is the point here. So you start off, when you meditate, you start off by starting to discover what the meaning of these terms are. Of course, we all have some idea what desire means. But then as you go deeper and deeper in the meditation, you start to acquire an understanding of deeper and deeper levels of this idea of desire. And it's only when you actually go beyond desire that you have the full understanding, because then you can see the full range. As long as you are still haven't gone beyond it yet, you can still assume that there is a more subtle level available, possible at least for the mind. So the moment you have gone beyond, only then have you really seen lust or desire to its full extent. So this is what it means here by understanding desire. It means understanding it in a full breadth. Only then have you really understood it. And this is what it means with all these factors, all these five factors, all these five hindrances. It's about understanding them to their full extent. And the only way to do that is to go beyond them. And then, only then will you understand it. So it's a gradual evolution that takes part in your practice, that you gradually gain a deeper and more full understanding of what these hindrances actually are. And then when you have overcome the hindrances and you have contemplated them this way, and again you will see here that this is a mixture of samatha and vipassana. It's vipassana part here is actually the understanding of the defilements. When you understand them, when you see things clearly, that is part of the vipassana side of things. But because you see them clearly, and because this is explained in places like the Anapanasati Sutta as a samatha path, you also become more peaceful and more calm. So these two, again, they go around each other. As you understand these things better, you become more peaceful. As you become more peaceful, you understand them better. And it's gradually, you calm down. And then, when eventually you overcome the hindrances completely, that is when the next factors here that are explained afterwards here come up. And this is the exalted mind, the unsurpassed mind, the concentrated mind, and the liberated mind. And the exalted mind, this is in the Pali called the Mahagata Chitta. Mahagata is the kind of mind that you have when you practice metta, you practice the Brahma Viharas. This is the mind which is very expansive, which has no barriers in it. They call it in the suttas the mind rid of barriers, because it's like it's not as if you don't have anybody in the whole world that you have any anger or hatred against. So it's rid of barriers. It is free kindness and love, if you like, compassion, going out to just anybody. There's no limit. That's why it is a Mahagata mind, an exalted mind. So these are the mind without hindrances. The unsurpassed mind, this is like the mind, again, it's a similar kind of thing. It's a mind in samadhi. When we talk about the Brahma Viharas, we talk about samadhi, and we talk about, so these are the same, just different aspects of the same type of mind state. The concentrated mind, again, is the samadhi mind, so this usually would refer to things like the jhanas, normally, and then the liberated mind in this context means the mind that are liberated from the defilements, from the hindrances. And again, this usually in sutta usage at this stage refers to samadhi and jhanas. So all of these four factors at the bottom here refer to samadhi attainments. So what you do here, again, you understand the mind state that these things actually refer to. And of course, the only way you can understand that is by attaining these states of samadhi yourself. So you attain them, and then you know what these things are all about. So there is this thing, you can see here what's happening here is that you purify the mind until it's completely pure, you attain samadhi, and then you go beyond that, and you go to deeper and deeper stages of samadhi, and then you understand, you're not really purifying the mind anymore, but by going into deeper samadhi, you are empowering the mind even further, even beyond purifying it from the hindrances, if you can see what I mean. So in this way, it is a path which continues to very, very deep levels. So that is the contemplation of the mind, is to understand various stages of the mind. And then you have the insight chapter, the insight paragraph which comes afterwards, which I have talked about before. I'll briefly mention it again. And it goes as follows. In this way, he abides contemplating mind as mind internally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind externally, or he abides contemplating mind as mind both internally and externally, or else he abides contemplating in the mind its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in mind its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in mind its nature of both arising and vanishing, or else mindfulness that there is mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind as mind. So here, the first section here is about contemplating mind as mind internally, and that refers to yourself, so you're contemplating your own mind, and you just understand these states as they actually are. And this first aspect here is usually considered the samatha part of this insight refrain, which is mentioned here. I think the idea of saying it's insight is really misleading here. That is like a heading which has been inserted by the translator here, or perhaps by, I'm not sure where it comes from, but it's misleading because this is not about insight necessarily, it's about a mixture again of vipassana and samatha. So this can certainly refer to samatha as well. And elsewhere in the Digha Nikaya it specifically says that this is a samadhi practice. So for that this is... that is a little bit misleading. So the first part here is then internally you reflect on your own mind, or you contemplate your own mind and you understand your own mind in this way. Then the next one is contemplating the mind externally. That means contemplating other people. And that, of course, refers here to inferential knowledge. You know that if your mind is this way, then other people's minds are going to be in the same way, or animals or whatever beings you talk about. And then finally, you have the contemplation both internally and externally. And this is where you reach the point where you understand, you universalize this, and you understand that internal and external minds, my own mind, other beings' mind, is all the same. It doesn't matter what mind it is. They all work in essentially the same thing here, same way. So they're all the same. It becomes a universal understanding that this is what minds are like. And once you have that universal understanding here, then you know that it doesn't matter where you get reborn, what kind of mind you acquire in the future, even if you get to go to a wonderful place next time or whatever it is, it doesn't matter what you do, because mind is always going to be mind. It's always going to be subject to these kind of defilements, these kind of problems, and the impermanences, etc., and the suffering, which is part of being part and parcel of being a mind. And that is the important thing there. So there isn't any escape, basically, from this impermanence, from these various states. Mind is like this, and it will always be like that, regardless of what you do. And then you have what is then can be called the insight part, which comes afterwards. The first part is more to do with samatha, then you have the insight part. So here it says, hereby is contemplating mind, its nature of arising, contemplating in mind its nature of vanishing, contemplating in mind its nature of both arising and vanishing. So the idea here is that you understand the radical impermanence of the mind, that things arise in the mind and then they disappear completely. And then you see this thing together, the arising and vanishing together, and that is what is meant here by, this is of course the deep insight into the nature of the mind as being absolutely impermanent, and not only going up and down, but actually vanishing and arising, coming from nothing, going to nothing. Yeah, that is what this insight is all about. But as I think some people have pointed out in comparative studies of the Satipatthana Sutta, it is really the first aspect here, the contemplating mind internally and externally, and both internally and externally, that seems to be the more original aspect of the Satipatthana, whereas the understanding this vipassana part here, or this is a very deep state of vipassana when you can see the mind arising and vanishing completely, this really belongs to something which comes after Satipatthana, when you have the power of samadhi to be able to investigate the mind much more deeply, much more profoundly. Because this is the kind of stuff which leads basically to the stages of awakening, this sort of contemplation. And then you have the last part here. Or else mindfulness that there is a mind is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. I would say a good translation of that is rather than bare knowledge and mindfulness, for partial knowledge and mindfulness. Jnana matta. Matta means like a measure in Pali. So it's a measure of knowledge, not the full one. It's just a measure. It's a limited amount of knowledge and a limited amount of mindfulness. So this, I think, might very well be a reference to a stream entry. You have partial knowledge of what is going on, because the last part here is clearly a reference to arahantship, to full awakening. One abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is the full understanding of mind when you get to that point. So what you can see here, this is something I mentioned last time, I mentioned it again. When you look at this paragraph, which is labeled as insight, but probably should not be labeled that way at all. But when you look at this paragraph, you can see the first aspect here is mostly the samatha aspect, the calming down, perhaps with some vipassana included, that leads to samadhi. And then you have the insight part, which is here the yathabhuta nanadasana, seeing things as they actually are, which is the second part, the insight part, and then that leads then to stream entry here, and then arahantship at the very end there. So you can see a gradation, you can see almost the whole sequence of the path in that little paragraph there. So that leads us on to the next contemplation. If you have any questions, please ask as we go along here. John here. Just 1 second, let's go.
The statement here, unsuppressed mind.
Unsurpassed.
Unsurpassed. Yeah. What's that really referring to?
It seems to refer to samadhi, unsurpassed. It's a mind which is unsurpassed. It's like the mind which is has reached a level. You know, maybe you have gone beyond the hindrances and you can't go any further beyond the hindrances. So it's unsurpassed in that sense. Each jhana level is unsurpassed in a certain way here. You know, like the third jhana is unsurpassed in terms of happiness, because you can't get any higher happiness than the third jhana in terms of happy feeling here. The second jhana is unsurpassed in terms of piti, because the highest type of piti, rapture, you can have. So something like that. I must admit, it's a little bit obscure, this term. It's not something which occurs many places in the suttas, but it seems to be basically a reference to samadhi and jhanas in particular here. Possibly also the Brahma Viharas, you're unsurpassed in terms of metta and karuna and these kind of things as well. Yeah. Okay, so let us move on to the last of the contemplations. This is called here the contemplation of mind objects. And the Pali for mind object is Dhamma. Dhamma is this very wide term, and it can mean many different things in many different contexts, depending on what it's about. And one of the meanings of Dhamma, sometimes it can mean like states, like, you know, like a phenomena, mental phenomena in a sense, is one meaning of Dhamma. Another one, of course, is the teaching of the Buddha. But another meaning of Dhamma is like law. It's a law of how things work. So often you say that things are Dhammata. Dhammata means that they are lawful. They operate according to a certain law. And of course, the most important laws in Buddhism are things like dependent origination and just general causality, that things have a causal basis. And I think the meaning here And I'm following Ajahn Sujato. He wrote a long book about Satipatthana, which is very interesting. And he argues strongly there that Dhamma in this context means the law of conditionality, and that this is really a contemplation of the lawfulness of conditionality in the last part here. And if you look at the various types of exercises that are mentioned here, you will see that that makes good sense. Because mind objects, you could say, well, we were just talking about mind just a second ago, about mind with desire, mind with anger, all these things. Well, that is mind objects. What distinguishes this last Satipatthana to the other ones is not the fact that one is mind objects and the other ones is not. What distinguishes it is the fact that this has to do with conditionality, with a cause and effect, basically. Another interesting aspect of this last Satipatthana, and this is something I was talking about last time as well, and this is when you do comparative studies of the Satipatthana Sutta, with a Pali, there's a couple of Chinese versions of this sutta. I think there are actually three Chinese versions of this sutta. There is three Abhidhamma versions of this sutta. And when you look at compare all these different versions of the suttas, it's easier to come down to what may have been an original Satipatthana Sutta. And what you find is that when you do that comparison of the Satipatthana Sutta, you find that it is the contemplation of the five hindrances and the contemplations of the seven awakening factors. These are the two aspects that you find across the board in all aspects of this contemplation of conditionality. But the three other ones, in particular, the contemplation of the five aggregates and the four noble truths, which are also mentioned here, they are only found in the Pali and nowhere else. And the contemplation of the six sense bases is found in some version, but in about half the versions it is not found. So because of that, it's the kind of conclusion you almost have to draw in this kind of case is that those things that are in common between all the different versions is likely to be the most ancient part, and things that are not in common are likely to have then been added later on, possibly by mistake, possibly because they wanted to fill it out and they thought they added some more contemplations in there. So because of that, it is those parts which are, I think, the most important aspects of this contemplation of conditionality. The five hindrances and the seven awakening factors. And when you look at those, you will see that those two in particular are very much to do with conditionality. You want to understand them, and you also want to understand how they arise and how they disappear in your practice. So, let's just read out what it says here about the five hindrances which comes first. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects? Or how does he abide contemplating a certain type of conditionality among other types of conditionality? Here, a bhikkhu abides contemplating conditionality among conditionalities in terms of the five hindrances. And how does he do this? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. So again, you can see there is some strong similarities here between the contemplation of the mind. First of all, he's supposed to know that there is sensual desire in me, or there is no sensual desire in me. And this is direct parallel to the previous contemplation of mind, that the mind is affected by lust or unaffected by lust. It's exactly the same thing here. And again, the point is also the same, that you understand sensual desire, this is kama raga or kama chanda perhaps in this context, You understand the full breadth and the full scale of sensual desire. You understand in its most refined and most minute things. This is what is meant here. So gradually, as you meditate, you expand your understanding of this term, until one day you go completely beyond sensual desire, and that's when you have the full understanding of what it is. And that is also when you understand there is no sensual desire in me. And once you have been beyond it once, then of course it is easy to recognize in the future when this factor arises again. And then comes the conditionality part of this. He understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire. So here we are more in the territory of vipassana, of clear seeing, understanding conditionality, understanding how things act together. And of course this is very important. If you are going to be successful in overcoming these states of mind, the negative states of mind, the defilements, you have to understand how they come into being. What are the conditions for these states of mind? And of course the condition for the arising of unarisen sensual desire is always how you look upon a particular object of the five senses. And if you look upon that object as beautiful, as something attractive, then desire will arise for that object. That is always always how this thing arises. And that is what you then, one thing is saying it, another thing is actually seeing it in yourself. You can actually see the connection. That's when it becomes really powerful. Just saying it doesn't do that much, but it gives you a kind of guideline for where to look when you do your meditation practice. And he comes to know the abandoning of arisen sensual desire. So if you already have arisen sensual desire, you know that the way to abandon that is to not focus on the beauty in the object that you have desire for. So you place your attention differently. You see that there's other aspects of this object. You see that it is impermanent, it is liable to change, its beauty is liable to fade, and all these kind of things. And when you understand that, when you place your attention in a different way, with a different framework, then that desire will slowly abate and disappear. So that is how the disappearance comes into being. Of course, it's often very difficult. Once desire has arisen, it's very hard to overcome it, because it's like you have already a skewed view of the thing, and it's often very difficult to fix that up. So what you often have to do instead is you have to do like preventative measures beforehand. So you have to train yourself in looking at things in a new and different way, and only then will you be able to avoid the arising of strong desires in the future. And this is also what the last part is about here. There comes to be the future. He understands how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. And how that happens is in two ways. And one way is that you contemplate regularly the unattractive aspect, the aspect of something which takes away the beauty perception in something. And by doing that, you are making it much more difficult for sensual desire to rise in the future. But of course, the most powerful way of doing this, and this is what eventually one hopes for in Buddhism, is to get to the point where you actually do see the Dhamma for yourself. You become a stream enter. And then, once you become a stream enter, you realize that, well, the reason why sensual desire arises, really, is because of the sense of self inside of you. As long as you have the sense of self, you have the sense of gratifying that self. That self wants to feel pleasure in the world. It wants to be happy. It wants to own things. It wants to own things that can gratify these desires. And that sense of self is ultimately the reason why sensual desire arises in the first place. And you understand, once you're a stream mentor, that it is by abandoning the sense of self that sensual desire also eventually will be abandoned. So that is like the root cause of the problem. And that's why so much in Buddhism centers around the sense of self and the problems that the sense of self gives rise to. So that is the first hindrance here. And as you can see, this is very much about conditionality. It's about understanding how this works. And this, of course, is a very important part of the Dhamma. And then you find the same kind of analysis, the same kind of understanding for the other, for hindrances, for ill will, and for sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and for doubt. And in all these cases, the bhikkhu understands, there is doubt in me. Or there being no doubt in him, he understands, there is no doubt in me. He understands how there comes to be the arising of doubt, how there comes to be the abandoning of doubt, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned doubt. And in all these cases, there's a similar thing. So again, with ill will, you understand it in its full scope. You understand it when it's completely abandoned. You understand the causes that give rise to ill will. And of course, the causes that give rise to ill will is seeing the repulsive aspect of something, the negative aspect of something, something which is not delightful. That gives rise to, often can give rise to ill will. And then by, instead of seeing the negative aspect of something, but you focus on the beauty of something instead, that in a sense having metta, then that abandons the ill will for that particular object. That's why metta is the counterpart of ill will and the thing which actually abandons it. And then by developing metta, because metta is basically seeing the beautiful, then by developing that, then there comes the future non-arising of abandoned ill will. And again, the same thing as before, is only when you become a stream entry that you really can abandon that ill will completely. The same thing is true of sloth and torpor, and restlessness and remorse. And both of these factors are very closely connected with the first two hindrances. If you have the first two hindrances, you will often have these two hindrances as well. And if you abandon the first two, then both sloth and torpor and restlessness and remorse will be very, very weak. They may still appear in very faint guises, but basically they will tend to disappear at that point. And the same thing is true of doubt. Doubt is a kind of way of looking at things, not understanding things properly, not having thought about the Dhamma, not having understood what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. And by reflecting on that in a, from a Buddhist point of view, unwise way, you have doubt about these issues. But if you are, if you reflect what is from a Buddhist point of view a wise way, you will understand what are the wholesome qualities, what are the unwholesome qualities. In other words, what are hindrances, what are non-hindrances, what are enlightenment factors, what are non-enlightenment factors, what is mindfulness, what is samadhi, what is kindness, what is metta, all these things. And it is by understanding those things in the right way, that is basically what the overcoming of doubt is all about. So there you are. Those are the five hindrances. And now you will... Interesting thing here, which comes up now, because now you have this paragraph on the next page, which is called, again, it's called insight, and it's the same paragraph as before. And, of course, the strange thing now, and this is where you can see that the sutta seems to have been cobbled together in a way which doesn't make necessarily absolute sense. Because the first part here makes good sense. You contemplate these hindrances internally, and then you contemplate that other people also have these hindrances, that's externally, and then you universalize internally and externally being the same. There is no escape from these things. But then it has, you contemplate the nature of arising, you contemplate the nature of vanishing, and you contemplate the nature of both arising and vanishing. And of course, we have just been talking about the arising and vanishing of these five hindrances. That's part of the exercise itself. And now it talks about it again. And that is one hint that this particular paragraph of arising and vanishing here doesn't necessarily, may not belong there, because it has already been talked about in the actual framework of the five hindrances itself. So that may be an indication that this, as some people have argued, that this may not actually be a part which belongs in there, right there, which is interesting here. And again, that is because some of these insights here can probably should also be left for a later stage of the path, later stage of the practice. Okay, apart from that, that paragraph there called insight is the same as the other one. And there's not much more to add, I think. Yeah. Then we have the contemplation of the five aggregates. And as I mentioned before, this particular paragraph on the aggregates only occurs in the Pali. It doesn't actually occur anywhere else in any of the other versions of this particular sutta. And when you read this paragraph, you see that it has been cut out of other parts of the Pali Sutras and almost pasted in here. It reads word for word in exactly the same way here as it reads other places in the Pali. And usually the contemplation of the five aggregates is something that comes towards the very end of the Buddhist path. You often see it when somebody makes a breakthrough to complete and final awakening, either that or maybe just a step before that. This is the contemplation they use. So again, I think that probably this originally was used more specifically to talk about just the contemplation to attain awakening. Then it was maybe brought into the Satipatthana Sutta and then acquired perhaps a broader meaning after it was applied to the Satipatthana Sutta. But I think it's fair to assume that this was not originally part of this. Anyway. So let us see what it says. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects. In other words, conditionality among conditionalities in terms of the five aggregates affected by clinging. And how does he do that? Here, a bhikkhu understands such is material form, such is origin, such is disappearance. Such as feeling, such as origin, such as disappearance, such as perception, such as origin, such as disappearance, such are formations, such the origin, such the disappearance, such as consciousness, such its origin, such its disappearance. So you can see here, this is very profound because here we are looking at the whole human being or every aspect of the human being. And once you understand every aspect of the human being as impermanent, as non-self, as affected by suffering, of course, this is what then leads to awakening. So these are basically awakening contemplations. And that's why I think, again, because they are such profound things, they really belong to a stage of the path later than Satipatthana. They belong to a stage of the path which comes after samadhi. And that is normally called in the suttas sammanjana, right knowledge, or is called yathabhuta jnanadasana, the seeing of things as they actually are. But just briefly, I won't go through this in too much detail because, as I said, I think it really belongs somewhere else. But such is material form. Again, it just means understanding material form in all its manifestations, so you understand the full extent of it. Such as origin means to understand where it comes from. And for material form, when we talk about the physical body, obviously where it arises is at birth and its disappearance is at death. So this actually is a very broad kind of phenomena. This is a physical form, can last for a very long period of time. So that is what is meant here by physical form, as I understand it. And feeling, such as feeling, its origination and disappearance. Again, it's about understanding feeling in all its aspects and manifestation to the full extent. And the more fully you understand it, of course, the easier it is to deal with it and to actually abandon it because you understand its limitations, etc. And the origin of feeling, now here we're talking quite differently from material form, because with feeling it's a mental phenomena, and mental phenomena, they come and go all the time. So the origin of feeling is always through dependent origination, is contact. So it is contact which gives rise to feeling, and that contact comes through how we're using the sensory apparatus. So it is the sensory apparatus that is the origination of feeling. So again, if you want to end feeling, if you understand its unsatisfactoriness, its suffering, you have to actually end the sensory apparatus. And the same thing, such disappearance of feeling, well, it disappears once that contact through a particular sensory organ ceases. Well, then that feeling ceases as well. It's completely dependent on that particular sensory organ at that particular time. So it comes and goes, often in very, very rapid succession, these particular feelings. And you can see that it's something which basically is out of your control. And then you have the perceptions next. Again, you understand the full range of perception. Perception is a very, very wide category. It has to do with how we relate to the world, how we're able to differentiate things, how, in the sutta, as it often said, how you're able to understand, for example, different colors. Red, blue, yellow, whatever. The fact that you can differentiate those colors is an aspect of perception. But any kind of differentiation you use in the world, how you differentiate between friend and enemy, how you differentiate between words that are spoken, any way that we make sense of the world is an aspect of perception. And again, it comes through contact, just like feeling. It arises through contact. So it is the sensory apparatus that gives rise to these perceptions. And its disappearance also happens when that contact ceases. Formations, this is the will, the volition of the mind. That's what it means in terms of the five khandhas. So this is, again, all aspects of the will in the mind. And that will, the origin of the will, is actually two things. It's feeling on the one hand, because once you feel, you act on that feeling because of craving. That's the one thing you need to have will. The second thing is you have to have ignorance or avidya, which is the very first link in dependent origination here. Because when you have feeling, you feel something, you want to act on it, the reason you act on that feeling in the wrong way is because of ignorance, not understanding what that feeling really is. And that ignorance then gives rise to craving, and that craving is what makes you want to control feelings, this and that way. When you understand through the practice of the Dhamma that you can't really control these things, there's nothing you can do about it, and you understand the nature of non-self, which is basically part and parcel of the same thing, that is when you stop craving, you stop using the will to try to control those feelings, because you have seen that you can't really do that. So that is the origin of formations, is avidya, ignorance. And its disappearance is when ignorance ceases. And then you have consciousness. Again, understanding consciousness. This is a bare knowing, the ability to know things. Its origin is said to be nama-rupa. This is the other aspects of the mind and the body which support consciousness. And its disappearance is when nama-rupa, the other aspects of mind and body, disappear, then consciousness also disappears. Because consciousness is 100% dependent on the other aspects of mind and the body. It cannot stand without these things. In the suttas, you have the simile of the sheaves of reed. You have two sheaves of reed leaning against each other. On the one side, you have nama-rupa, which is mind or the other khandhas, if you like, the feelings and perceptions and body, and then you have consciousness on the other side. So consciousness has to exist in dependence of these other aspects. So if you want to end, if you find that the consciousness is suffering and you want to end it, the only way you can do that is by ending nama-rupa, which means ending rebirth in the future. In that way, your consciousness also comes to an end. So when you see that it's suffering, then that is what you do. So that is the five aggregates. I don't want to go into more detail because I'm going to be here a long time. Does anybody have any questions at this stage? You all happy? I've got a few questions here come in from various places overseas, actually. So let me just take a few questions from overseas before I move on. I shall try to go through the rest fairly quickly afterwards. This is from Indira Fernando in Sri Lanka. And she says, in day-to-day life, if we exercise mindfulness as in this sutta, be aware of your body, aware of your feelings, about your mind conditions, will it help keep our monkey mind checked? Okay, I think the Satipatthana Sutta is really about meditation at a fairly deep level. It's not the sort of thing you can actually do in daily life. Satipatthana is usually when you sit down cross-legged. If you think about the Anapanasati Sutta, for example, Anapanasati is a classical way of doing Satipatthana. That's how it's explained. You always sit down, first of all, cross-legged, you close your eyes, and you establish mindfulness in front of you. It's not something you can do in your daily practice. The daily practice, rather, is about being virtuous, being a good person, and exercising some degree of sense restraint. That is what daily practice is about. And of course, to exercise sense restraint, you have to have a certain mindfulness. So any practice you do to establish mindfulness is great. And that sense restraint just means that you don't no longer react to external objects with so much desire, so much negativity or anger, so much aversion that you ordinarily would do. You have enough mindfulness to be aware. You can see desire is about to rise. You know this is going to be suffering, and then you're able to turn in another direction. You look at something else instead. You think in a different way here. And by doing that, you can actually avoid a lot of that suffering which comes from the senses not being restrained. This is what you should do in daily life. And certainly, the most important part, I think, in lay life, sense restraint is more difficult than in monastic life. The most important thing is to look after your virtue. If you look after your virtue, then when you go on retreat, you will have a fair chance to actually get some good meditation on retreat. So that is the first one. And the next one question here is from Shu in New Jersey, USA. How do I apply this Satipatthana Sutta to daily activities as a lay practitioner? And is it okay to do so even though your mindfulness is not strong? As I said, I don't think you can apply Satipatthana Sutta to daily activities. Think more in terms of virtue and sense restraint. That's what it's really about. I did talk about the early aspect of Satipatthana earlier on, back in November, and if you want to listen to that, you can say what I have to say there about contemplating the postures of the body and the daily activities. And when you have, if you listen to that, you will probably understand that I normally don't consider that proper Satipatthana as such. Satipatthana is more an active meditation when you sit down and you focus on things like the 32 parts of the body or the feelings. Okay, one last question. This is from Sunil, also from New Jersey, USA. But it must be very midnight or whatever, or very early morning in the USA. That's very committed over there. That's good. So this is the, again, Anapanasati Sutta is defined in terms of the Satipatthana Sutta. So it seems Satipatthana is more fundamental in nature. Based on the Buddha's own enlightenment, it seems he attained enlightenment practicing Anapanasati. So shouldn't this be the other way around? Why the goal of Anapanasati should be to satisfy Satipatthana? Okay, I think it's very hard to say which is more fundamental. I think the point is that the Anapanasati Sutta explains how to do Satipatthana. It gives you a framework. Sometimes when you look at the Satipatthana Sutta in its own right, like we have just done now, it tells you, well, you're supposed to watch the feelings, you're supposed to know the mind states, you're supposed to understand conditionality. But sometimes you wonder, how am I supposed to do this? It is not very clear. Should I just do it in daily activities, as some people suggest? Should I sit down and watch these feelings in the body? What exactly should I do? And that is the great thing with the Anapanasati Sutta. It gives you a very clear and systematic approach for how to do Satipatthana. It tells you that if you watch the breath, that is enough. If you watch it continuously through the various stages of happiness, of arising in the mind, of the nimittas, and all the way to jhana, when you watch the breath in all these aspects, then you are fulfilling Satipatthana. And I think that is a great thing to know, because sometimes I know many people are confused about Satipatthana practice, how to do it. It's very nice to have a very simple and straightforward answer to how to practice these things. So I think that if, to say that one is more basic in nature, I would rather say that one is an explanation of the other. So one explains how to do it. They're both Dhamma. They go together. You cannot really separate them. And it's, the fact that they go together is actually more important to say that one is more basic than the other one. Okay, so that was just a short interlude there of questions. And now I will get back again to the contemplation of conditionality in the Satipatthana Sutta. So the next contemplation of the conditionality here is of the six sense bases. And again, as I mentioned before, as I understand it, I don't think this is as original to this sutta as the enlightenment factors and the five hindrances. But just briefly, this is about understanding the six senses, understanding the eye, and understanding visual forms, and then understanding the fetter that arises dependent on both, in other words, both the eye and visual forms. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter, and how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. So again, understanding the eye and understanding forms here basically means that you understand again the limits and the scope of what can be seen, of what is possible to experience through the eye. And once you know the scope and the range of possibilities, you also understand the limitations of visual sight, of seeing things. And of course, once you understand the limitations, then it's easier to give it up, because you know that there's something better and more beyond visual forms. And then you understand that the fetter that arises depending on both. Well, this is the desire that arises because of the eye and form. The fetter, the thing which binds you there, is the desire to either just to be able to see, or the desire for specific forms out there. So these things go together. So you have the desire to see, and you have the desire for forms. And you understand how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter, how there comes to be the abandoning of that desire for these things. And again, that of course comes about because you understand that the suffering basically inherent in these particular aspects. And then the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter again comes through eventually becoming a stream enter when you can ban everything. And the same thing is true for the nose, the same is true for flavors, the tongue and flavors, the body and tangibles, the mind and mental objects. Exactly the same principle goes for all of these. You understand the scope of these, you understand the desire which binds you to the objects, and you understand how there comes to be the abandoning of that desire by understanding its limitations and understanding that there's something else beyond which is worthwhile, more worthwhile than these things. That is very briefly the six sense bases. Then we come to the seven enlightenment factors. And these are things that stand in contrast to the five hindrances that we saw before. So first of all, you practice to abandon the five hindrances, and once they are abandoned, you move on, so to speak, to giving rise to the seven enlightenment factors. They are like the opposite side of the five hindrances. Once the five hindrances are gone, it doesn't mean that development of the mind stops. In fact, it continues. It continues on with the enlightenment factors. And this is why you develop the energy of the mind, the happiness of the mind, the joy, the concentration, and eventually the equanimity of the mind. And of course, these factors also had to be understood in terms of causality. Because when you understand them in terms of causality, that is when you can actually develop them more purposefully. So again, a bhikkhu abides contemplating conditionality among conditionalities in terms of the seven awakening factors. And how does he do that? Here, there being the mindfulness awakening factor in him, the bhikkhu understands there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. Or there being no mindfulness awakening factor in him, he understands there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor, and how the arisen mindfulness and awakening factor comes to fulfillment by development. And the mindfulness awakening factor here is in itself usually nothing but the four satipatthanas. So here, these things are sort of interlocked into each other. You are contemplating the mindfulness enlightenment factor through satipatthana, and that itself is satipatthana. So it's like an endless loop or something like that. So you understand what mindfulness is. You understand what that clarity of mind is when the hindrances are mostly removed, when the mind is clear, when there isn't much thinking going on, and you have the ability to contemplate things. You understand what that actually is. And again, that happens, of course, when you reach that point. And gradually, as you get there, you get a fuller understanding of this mindfulness enlightenment factor. And because you understand what it is, it also means that you understand when it's not present. So these are two sides of the same coin. It's only through understanding its presence that you can also understand its absence. And then he understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness factor. And basically, how that arising comes about is what I mentioned before, is through the practice of the Eightfold Path, is through the purification of the mind, the purification of virtue, that mindfulness arises. Often, and this is one of the things that I think is sometimes maybe misunderstood, people often think that mindfulness comes about as a function of the will. If you have enough willpower, if you just want to be mindful, then mindfulness is going to arise. But if you use willpower to give rise to mindfulness, it's not going to be sustainable. And you're going to feel tired. And after a while, the mindfulness will disappear because the mind becomes tired instead. So the real way to become mindful is to put in the causes, and that's why the causality is mentioned specifically here. Put the causes in that give rise to mindfulness. And those causes are always the purity of the mind, the virtue, if you like, both on the verbal and the bodily level, but also on the mental level. And by practicing that virtue, and by in particular doing things like metta practice, which purifies the mind, that is where that mindfulness factor arises after a while quite naturally because of that. And that is the ideal way for mindfulness to arise. And he understands how the mindfulness awakening factor comes to fulfillment by development. And of course, this is again the understanding usually of the Aryas, the people who are on the path, who have seen the Dhamma, because they know that the fulfillment of this happens through the development, basically, of the Eightfold Path. But it is gradually, until you reach full awakening, the mindfulness becomes more and more powerful. Then you have the same kind of thing for the other factors of awakening. You have the investigation of states, awakening factor. You have the energy awakening factor. You have the rapture awakening factor, the tranquility awakening factor, the concentration awakening factor, and then the equanimity awakening factor. And the bhikkhu understands there is the equanimity awakening factor in me. And there being no equanimity awakening factor in him, he understands there is no equanimity awakening factor in me. And he also understands how it comes to be the arising of the unarisen equanimity awakening factor, and how the arisen equanimity awakening factor comes to fulfillment by development. So in all of these cases, you see the same principle. You understand what these things are. Investigation of states, awakening factor, basically is understanding the various mental qualities you can have. Understanding which ones are wholesome and good that you want to develop, and which ones are not good and which leads to a decline in spiritual qualities. So that is the first one, the energy enlightenment factor. This is the virya in the Pali. And this, again, is something which arises quite naturally in the mind at this stage. So as you understand the unwholesome factors of the mind, you understand the wholesome ones, there comes a natural energy because you want to get rid of, so to speak, the bad ones and develop the good ones. And you get very keen to do that. And that keenness inside, that sense of urgency, the sense of inspiration that you get by seeing this, this is that natural energy which flows from inside. And this is the best kind of energy. As long as you have to put forth a lot of effort yourself, it is much more tiring when the energy comes by itself. That is when it becomes really powerful. And you understand where this comes from. Again, with the awakening factors, it's exactly the same thing as with the Noble Eightfold Path. They are a conditioned sequence. So once you have mindfulness, that is when investigation of states happen, because you have the ability to investigate properly once mindfulness is there. Once you investigate properly, the energy will arise because you will want to do something about it. Once the energy arises, the rapture, the piti, comes. That's an aspect of the energy, is that rapture of the mind. So these follow each other. From the rapture comes the tranquility of the mind. From the tranquility comes the concentration. From the concentration, the highest peak of concentration is the equanimity. And this refers mostly to the equanimity of the fourth jhana. So here you can see how each one of these comes into being as conditioned by the previous one. And in each case, your job is to understand this factor in its fullness, what it means in its fullness. Then to understand that the previous factor is what conditions it. So you understand in each case how the previous factor leads to this factor. And eventually you also understand how each factor comes through fulfillment by developing it through the Noble Eightfold Path. So these are very high states of mind, and these are all basically dealing with samadhi and jhanas. And they're called enlightenment factors precisely because they lead to enlightenment, they lead to awakening. Once you have the equanimity of the fourth jhana, basically you are there. There isn't much more you have to do beyond that. Okay, so that is the seven enlightenment factors. Then you have the Four Noble Truths, and again, the Four Noble Truths only exist in the Pali, and as I understand it, it is not what was originally part of the Satipatthana Sutta. And the way the Four Noble Truths are mentioned here, they are mentioned in exactly the same way. They're not really mentioned as contemplations. They're mentioned in exactly the same way that they are mentioned when you become a stream enterer. So the way it is described here is, here a bhikkhu understands as it actually is, this is suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the origin of suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the cessation of suffering. He understands as it actually is, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And this usually, when you understand something as it actually is, in particular the Four Noble Truths, this is a way of saying, well, now you are a stream enterer because you have understood the Dhamma to its full depth. So again, I feel it doesn't fit the context all that well, because this is, rather than being a contemplation and something that leads to samadhi and leads to enlightenment, this actually describes pretty much one of the awakening experiences themselves. Okay, so that concludes the various exercises of the fourth Satipatthana, and then all we have left is the conclusion. And the conclusion runs as follows. Bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four focuses of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge, here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning here. So basically, final knowledge is awakening, it's arahantship, and non-returning is anagami, it's when you are almost fully awakened, but you have a slight, tiny little bit of clinging left, but apart from that, you have got there. So if you practice it for 7 years, it says, this is what happens. Then he goes, let alone 7 years, if you should develop these four focuses of mindfulness in such a way for 6 years, for 5 years, for 4 years, for 3 years, for 2 years, for 1 year, etc., etc. Again, the same thing can be expected. If you should develop them for 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 1 month, half a month. Again, the same thing can be expected, let alone half a month, if one should develop these four focuses of mindfulness in such a way for 7 days. One of two fruits could be expected for him. Either you become fully awakened, or if there is a trace of clinging left, you become a anagami, a non-returner. So, it's an interesting passage, because you wonder what exactly does this mean? You develop, does it mean that if you practice it properly for 7 years, this must happen? How can there be such a difference between 7 years and 7 days? What is going on here? And the point just seems to be that obviously people are at very different levels in the practice, and somebody might already have a very deep samadhi, for example, and this is a person who will make very, very quick progress. And somebody who is much lesser may indeed take, I think, even much longer than 7 years to actually fulfill these things. It all depends on where you are in your practice and how you're practicing. But the other thing is, and again, it's an interesting fact about this passage. You will have noticed there's a strange thing going on in this passage, which is the first one starts with 7 years, the first paragraph there. The next paragraph starts with 7 months. And the last one has 7 days in it. Why does it start with 7 years? Why does it start with 7 months? What is actually going on there? And it seems that the number seven has a kind of special significance very often. It has a kind of, maybe even a kind of mythical significance in many places. And by putting seven there, you are sort of applying a kind of mythical significance to the Satipatthana Sutta. So I don't know how literally this is to be understood, whether it is just to be understood that if you practice this well, you will quickly reach to the goal. This is the way to reach the goal, I think, really is probably the right way of understanding this particular paragraph. It is interesting that the Chinese version of this paragraph, it doesn't stop with 7 days, then goes on to say if you practice in 6 days, 5 days, it goes down to 1 day. So then you can wonder, well, which one is correct? And the point is, I think, it's not about one being correct or the other one correct. It is just basically an injunction to say, the better, the more you put these instructions into practice, the quicker will be your results. And of course, to be able to put these instructions into practice in the first place, you have to have mindfulness established already. The Satipatthana Sutta, as I mentioned at the very beginning, back in November, is that it has as a prerequisite that mindfulness is already established. So it already starts at a very high level. And this may be one reason why one has this ability to gain these high attainments so quickly. And then we have the very last paragraph here, and this is the same as the opening paragraph to the sutta. So it was with reference to this that it was said, because this is the path leading in one direction for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four focuses of mindfulness. And again here, the point here is, of course, that this is just about the direct path. It says here, ekayana mago, this is the path which leads in one direction only, or somebody suggested it might may even mean the path that leads to one, ekayano, in other words, a path that leads to samadhi, which is an interesting interpretation of that phrase. But this is the path which leads in one direction only, for the purification of beings. These, of course, are the things we're trying to achieve, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, in other words, for the ending of all problems, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way. This is a code for stream entry. True way is like seeing dependent origination, which is stream entry. And for the realization of Nibbana, which is the attainment of full awakening, arahatship. So this is the path, the four focuses of mindfulness, the four places where you focus mindfulness. That is what the Blessed One said, that the bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, any questions on all of that? Are you all happy? Yes.
Using merit as a way to offset ill will.
If using merit as a way to offset ill will, then is using sense restraint the way to offset desire?
It's part of it. There are many ways of offsetting desire. And one of them is, you know, when you see the beauty in something, it's to actually see the other side of that thing, seeing that it's not just attractive, it has a negative side as well. You know, food becomes rotten after a while. It's only beautiful for a short time. It's beautiful when you're hungry. When you're full, it doesn't really look so nice anymore. There's all these aspects to these things. And also there's a craving involved with these things. And the craving itself is somehow unpleasant rather than a peaceful state. So there's sense restraint is one aspect, but sometimes you need that ability to see the negative aspect of something to be able to do sense restraint. For example, if you walk around and you see something attractive, you will be drawn by desire very, very quickly unless you're able to turn your mind in a different direction. Now, one way of turning your mind in a different direction is to remind yourself straight away there is a negative aspect to this. It's not as good as it looks. It's impermanent. It is something I can't control in the long run. It's going to change. All these kind of things. So they go together, and when they go together, they become very powerful. Clear?
Thanks.
Anybody else want to ask any questions? Okay, good. So let us just pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha.